209-2950 or go to givetowbai.org online. Yeah, tomorrow will be Thanksgiving, and I guess I would have to go to that rhetoric spiel about what to be thankful for. So if I have to go there, well, be thankful for a station that allows someone like me to say what I just said and other things that you hear 24/7. 212-209-2950 or go to givetowbai.org online. It's 6 p.m. Stay tuned.
The situation in Iran is critical, with reports of children being killed, injured, and detained at anti-government protests. We'll get an update. All that and more coming up. Now, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Cairo, Egypt. In Chesapeake, Virginia, a gunman shot dead at least six people inside a Walmart Tuesday night. CNN reports the suspect is believed to be an employee or former employee of the store. There are reports he opened fire on other Walmart workers in a break room. Authorities have confirmed the shooter also died, possibly of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. The shooting at the Walmart comes just 3 days after a gunman shot dead five people at Club Q, an LGBTQ plus nightclub in Colorado Springs. According to the Gun Violence Archive, there have been more than 600 mass shootings in the United States this year. House Democrats investigating Donald Trump may soon have access to 6 years of his tax returns. On Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court rejected the former president's attempt to block the Treasury Department from turning over his tax returns. The court's ruling ends a three-year battle, but comes just weeks before the Democrats lose control of the House. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has accused Russia of turning the cold winter weather into a weapon of mass destruction by attacking Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Millions of Ukrainians are expected to go months without heat or electricity following recent Russian strikes. The head of the Ukrainian power grid warned Tuesday of mass blackouts.
For you to understand the scale of these attacks and what we have to deal with, practically all thermal and hydro generations, meaning major power stations, have been damaged by missile attacks.
In other news on the war, Russia's denounced Ukrainian security forces for raiding a 1,000-year-old Russian Orthodox Christian monastery in Kyiv as part of a probe into whether the religious site is being used to assist Russia's war efforts. Over the past 9 months, Ukrainian forces have arrested at least 33 Orthodox priests on suspicion of aiding Russia. Meanwhile, in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin met Tuesday with the Cuban President Miguel Diaz-Canel, who criticized U.S. sanctions targeting Russia.
Куба энергично осуждает.
Куба actively condemns sanctions that unilaterally and unfairly are imposed over the Russian Federation. The reasons for the current conflict in this zone must be sought in the aggressive policy of the United States and the expansion of NATO towards Russian borders.
Turkey is threatening to launch a ground invasion of northern Syria as part of its ongoing assault on Kurdish groups in the area following a deadly bombing in Istanbul on November 13th. Turkey's claiming it's killed 184 Kurds in recent attacks on northern Syria and Iraq. Meanwhile, Iran is escalating its own attack on Kurdish areas. One Kurdish human rights group estimates 42 people have been killed over the last week. We'll have more on Iran after headlines. Brazil's far-right president Jair Bolsonaro has formally filed a petition with Brazilian election authorities contesting the results of last month's runoff election, which he lost to former President Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva. Bolsonaro has asked Brazil's superior electoral court to toss out votes cast on older electronic voting machines, claiming without proof that the machines are faulty. Bolsonaro's request is expected to be rejected, but could raise tensions in Brazil ahead of Lula's inauguration on January 1st. In Colombia, new peace talks have begun between the Colombian government and the country's last remaining leftist guerrilla group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN. Colombia's first ever leftist president, Gustavo Petro, who's a former member of the guerrilla group M19, pushed for the negotiations to resume for the first time since 2019 in an effort to end nearly 60 years of conflict. This is Danilo Rueda, Colombia's high peace commissioner.
We believe that respect for differences unites us towards a common purpose. Respect for life, respect for freedom, and respect for the changes necessary to overcome a set of rights issues and inequalities that have been denied to so many sectors of the Colombian society. And this internal exercise that we are beginning to develop is what gives us certainty.
In Jerusalem, at least one person has died and 14 were injured after bombs exploded at two crowded bus stops this morning. Israeli authorities believe the bombs were likely detonated remotely. One of the blasts killed a 16-year-old Israeli-Canadian yeshiva student named Aryeh Shechopek. The attack in Jerusalem came hours after Israeli forces shot dead a 16-year-old Palestinian boy named Ahmed Shahada in the occupied West Bank. Palestinian officials say the teenager was shot in the heart during an Israeli military raid. So far this year, Israeli forces have killed at least 200 Palestinians, including more than 50 children. In China, hundreds of workers at the world's largest iPhone factory have clashed with Chinese police after walking off the job. Tension has been rising at the Foxconn plant over strict COVID-19 lockdowns and unpaid wages. Videos posted on social media show workers being tear gassed and beaten outside the plant. The Biden administration's extended a pause on federal student loan payments until the end of June as a court battle drags on over Biden's plan to cancel up to $20,000 of student debt per borrower. In a statement, Education Secretary Miguel Cardona said, quote, "We're extending the payment pause because it would be deeply unfair to ask borrowers to pay a debt that they wouldn't have to pay were it not for the baseless lawsuits brought by Republican officials and special interests," he said. The city of Atlanta has agreed to pay $1 million to the family of Rayshard Brooks, an unarmed 27-year-old African-American man who was shot dead by the police in 2020. The incident began when officers found him sleeping in a car in the parking lot of a Wendy's restaurant. Police shot him in the back as he attempted to run away from them after grabbing one of their tasers. One officer was heard on a body cam video saying, "I got him." A coalition of over 400 immigrant justice and human rights groups are urging the Biden administration to grant temporary protected status, or TPS, to more people from Haiti as the island nation faces a political and economic crisis with violence increasing in the streets. The efforts led by the Haitian Bridge Alliance are calling for current beneficiaries of TPS to be given more time in the program and for Biden officials to expand the relief to Haitians who fled to the United States after July 2021. The program temporarily shields immigrants from deportation and grants them permission to work in the U.S. TPS for Haitians is currently set to expire in 3 months in February of 2023. In labor news, the head of the American Federation of Teachers, Randy Weingarten, is denouncing former Secretary of State and possible presidential candidate Mike Pompeo after he claimed she was, quote, the most dangerous person in the world. Randy Weingarten said she suspects Pompeo made the comment in an appeal to billionaire Republican funders who want to dismantle public education.
This is the kind of rhetoric that creates the incitement and the hate and the divisiveness that we're seeing in America and around the world today. Let me be clear. What the AFT does and what teachers do every day in classrooms is that they're the antidote to this kind of destructive rhetoric.
More labor news. Starbucks is closing the first shop to unionize in Seattle, the coffee chain's home city. This is the fourth unionized Starbucks store in Seattle to be shut down since nationwide unionization efforts started. Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz warned in a video more stores would be closed soon, claiming safety concerns. But union leaders say the closures are part of the company's ongoing retaliation campaign against workers organizing. And Bloomberg's reporting Elon Musk's fortune has shrunk by over $100 billion this year due to the falling value of Tesla shares. Despite losing $100 billion, the new owner of Twitter remains the world's richest man. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. We're broadcasting live from downtown Cairo in Egypt with the Nile River flowing behind us. In Iran, where human rights authorities say the situation has become critical, with reports of dozens of children being killed, injured, and detained at recent anti-government demonstrations. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights said Tuesday that worsening repression by Iranian security forces has led to a rising number of deaths, especially in Kurdish cities. This is spokesperson Jeremy Lawrence.
Since the nationwide protests began on the 16th of September, over 300 people have been killed, including more than 40 children. Two 16-year-old boys were among six killed over the weekend. Protesters have been killed in 25 of Iran's 31 provinces, including more than 100 in Sistan and Balochistan. Iranian official sources have also reported that a number of security forces have been killed since the start of the protests. We call on the authorities to release all those detained in relation to the exercise of their rights, including the right to peaceful assembly, and to drop the charges against them. Our office also calls on the Iranian authorities to immediately impose a moratorium on the death penalty and to revoke death sentences issued for crimes not qualifying as the most serious crimes under international law.
This comes as the BBC reports authorities have not been releasing protesters' bodies unless their families remain silent. Some say they were pressured by security officials to go along with state media reports that their loved ones were killed by, quote, rioters. On Monday, Iran's national soccer team declined to sing the national anthem before their opening World Cup match in a sign of support for the protests.
Meanwhile, on Sunday, two of Iran's most prominent actresses were arrested after they voiced support for anti-government protests and appeared in public without wearing a hijab, as required by law. Ahead of her arrest on Sunday, Hengama Ghaziani wrote, "Whatever happens, know that, as always, I will stand with the people of Iran. This may be my last post," she wrote. Kahiyoun Riahi was also arrested and accused of acting against Iran's authorities. CNN reports Iran's security forces are using sexual assaults of male and female activists to quell the protests. This week, the UN Human Rights Council in Geneva set to hold a session on the protests with witnesses and victims in attendance, and will discuss a proposal to establish a fact-finding mission on the crackdown in Iran. Evidence of abuses could later be used in court. For more, we're joined by Nahid Siamdoust, assistant professor in Middle East and Media Studies at University of Texas in Austin, former journalist who's reported across the Middle East, including Iran. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Professor. If you could start off by talking about the critical situation in Iran right now and also the escalating attacks by the Iranian government on Kurdish areas.
Yes, in recent weeks, we've seen, especially within the Kurdish areas, Mahabad most recently, but Bukhan, Sanandaj, Saqqez, in all these cities, the Kurdish people have risen up, and people have risen up all over Iran, and the authorities are going very harshly against protesters. We see photo after photo on social media of people with, tens, sometimes hundreds of pellets in their bodies. Some of these people do not survive those shots, and as you already mentioned in your report, many of the people of the protesters who are killed are children. They're teenagers. They're teenagers who've taken their lives into their hands and gone into the streets to protest their living conditions, the bleak future that they're looking into, and really asking for a different future.
And could you explain specifically what is it, the relationship between Iran's central government and Kurdistan? So many of the protests, as you've pointed out, too, the epicenter has been in the Kurdish region. Could you explain what the relationship between the state following the revolution and Kurdistan has been?
Sure. So Kurdistan, Iran is a system of governance. So 30 governorates and states, so to speak. And so each state, including the Kurdish region, will have their own governors. So the central system controls these regions via the governors that they have in these areas. And they're oftentimes, they're always approved, of course, by the central state. But the people have risen up, and their religious leaders and sheikhs have spoken up in their defense. So, we've seen one of the sheikhs in Kurdistan joining the sheikh in Baluchistan in asking for an independent international body to oversee a referendum in Iran. And so, the forces that we see, the Sipahis that we see, the plainclothes officers and militia that we see in Kurdistan suppressing the uprising or the revolution there, they come from all kinds of different backgrounds, all supported by the central state, of course. And Kurdistan is very much, part of Iran, and this is something that the Kurdish leaders in that region have also stated. So, we have to be, when you talk about the central state and the Kurdish region, we have to be careful not to play into the regime's own discourse of this being a separatist movement.
No, absolutely. You're right about that. And I wanted to say also, if you could comment in addition to the reports that we're seeing now and that we said a bit in our introduction of the systematic use of sexual violence against prisoners, principally women protesters, but also men. What are you hearing about this on the ground? There have been reports widely publicized of attacks by security forces in public, but this is the first that we're hearing of attacks on prisoners, protesters who've been imprisoned.
Right. So a couple of weeks ago, there was a video published of a woman sort of open and public being, touched absolutely inappropriately, and that set off conversations about what is actually happening in terms of the sexual abuse of these prisoners. And more recently, a couple of days ago, there was a report by CNN with sort of women and others alleging that they've been sexually abused in these interrogation rooms. And we've seen other reports coming through on social media. The parents and the families of these detainees are very much pressured to keep silent. And so we don't really have a full account of what is happening in these interrogations. And we know they are abused physically, but the nature of the sexual abuse is something that still needs to really be narrated and come to the fore.
Can you talk about the defiance of the Iranian people, the women who are leading these protests, and the significance of what's happening right now in Qatar with the Iranian soccer team refusing to sing the national anthem of Iran before the game?
Right. We've seen, you know, Iranians across the board, all over the nation. As you mentioned, you know, people in 25 out of 30 states have been killed. And so this is really a nationwide revolution. The defiance has been astounding. The courage with which people have gone into the streets week after week, despite the killings that are happening, despite the, you know, also severe injuries. It doesn't just have to be deaths, people losing their eyes, people losing their limbs. Despite all of that, they've risen up and are, you know, continuing to protest. And now they've been joined, as you mentioned in your report, by actresses, by athletes, by, you know, teachers' unions and professors' unions and so on. The Iran national team at the World Cup refused to sing the national anthem. However, they have not been fully supported by Iranians at large. It's a very contested field. There are some among Iranians who are supporting their national team, but there are many who are not, because the national team had a visit with the conservative president, Ebrahim Raisi, right before their departure. And Iranians did not like to see their national team sort of bowing and, you know, being friendly with a president whom they see as being at the head of, you know, the repressive government, not the state, that would be the supreme leader, but leading the charge against women, not least because since he took office, he promised to bring morality to the streets. And this wave of protests that we see was not least caused by a year long of the morality police sort of upping the ante against women in the in public spaces. And so the national team meeting the president did not sit well with many Iranians. And, you know, they had a historical defeat at the World Cup, losing to England.
Professor Samdous, you, among others, have pointed out, of course, that there have been many protests in recent years in Iran, starting, of course, with the 2009 protests, which is the time that we spoke to you on Democracy Now. But there is something, as you've said, qualitatively different about the protests that are now ongoing. Could you talk about what those differences are and how you see this playing out? Do you think, despite the brutality of the state response, that these protests will go on?
Right. In 2009, which was the biggest protest movement since the 1979 revolution, we saw masses of people coming into the streets, you know, and one of the biggest, it was perhaps 2 or 3 million people at once. But this nature of the slogans was still very much about reforming the system from within. We saw people engaging with the Islamic discourse of the government, right? Going to their rooftops and calling Allahu Akbar, calling God, to sort of, you know, bring forth that kind of, you know, Islamic morality and decency, to bring the government into a motion of reforms. That is no longer the case. The revolution that we see now, and there's a lot of, you know, contestation around language as well. There are people who say we should no longer be calling this an uprising. This should definitely be called a revolution. It's not just a matter of semantics. I think in the nature of the slogans that we see, that this movement is no longer at all engaging with government discourse. There's no reference whatsoever to Islamic, you know, sort of slogans or phrases that people had been using and the government itself had been using. People are calling for a new system. In the 2009 Green Uprising, for example, people would band together and say, "Natarsim, natarsim, moba hamiba hamastim, don't be afraid, we're all together." And now it's kind of filtered around to people saying, "Bitarsid, bitarsid, Mohammed Bohamasim, you should be afraid, because we are all together." And then when we look at the slogans, you know, the harshness of it, sort of there's all notion of Persian politeness or any sense of respect for authority or any of that is completely out the window. And we see this in the cuss words that are used against the supreme leader, against the Sepah. They're ferocious. The slogans are ferocious. The movement is ferocious. And it's of a different nature because, you know, this movement is leaderless. And so it's There are groups of people all across Iran popping up here and there, but there are no leaders to be put down. So the regime can't, just like in 2009, go after the leaders of the movement and try to quell the movement through its leaders. It's a leaderless movement. It's a very smart movement that is sort of coming together and dissolving, and really sort of playing this strategic game, a very sort of organic strategic game against the forces.
Thank you so much, Professor Naheed Siamdous, Assistant Professor in Middle East and Media Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. She's a former journalist who's reported across the Middle East, including in Iran.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh, and we are broadcasting from downtown Cairo, Egypt, just in front of the Nile. And that concludes our broadcast from Egypt for the last 2 weeks.
Special thanks to the whole AP crew here in Cairo. Rania Khidr, Julian Jones, Ahmad Al-Naqib, Ahmad Hikmat, Ahmad Ali, and Alice Loka.
And special thanks to our Democracy Now! Team here in Cairo. Sharif Abdelkaddous, Nermeen Sheikh, Hani Massoud, and Dennis Moynihan. And in New York, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Efterina Nadura, Sam Alkafte, Maria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Mary Conlon. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Listeners, don't want to use the website or the call center to contribute to WBAI? That's okay. Please feel free to send your check or money order to WBAI, 3rd floor, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York, 11217. Please make your check or money order out to Pacifica-WBAI. We thank you for your donation and hope that you will spread the word and tell your friends. And please keep on listening.
Dear listener, keep WBAI going. Talk about our work. Tell a neighbor. Tweet a link. Or download a flyer at wbai.org/marketing-advertising. That's wbai.org/marketing-advertising. To help grow WBAI's listenership and income, come to meetings of the LSB Outreach and Fundraising Task Force on Monday, November 21st and 28th at 7 p.m. By phone, use any Zoom number like 646-558-8656. That's 646-558-8656. Our meeting number is 922-457-2995 or WBAI-LSB-995. That's 922-457-2995. The passcode is like our frequency, 995-995-99. That's 995-995-99. Again, that's Monday, November 21st and 28th for meetings of the WBAI-LSB Outreach and Fundraising Task Force. More information in the meeting section of WBAI.org.
Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update, a weekly program devoted to the economic dimensions of our lives and those of our children. I'm your host, Richard Wolf. Today's program is a little bit different. On the one hand, yes, it responds to something that we've been thinking about and looking at for weeks now, and that's namely the passing of the United Kingdom's Queen Elizabeth on the 8th of September of this year, and the enormous media attention that event, the funeral and so on, have garnered, as well as the coming to power of her son Charles III, the new king of that country. But it's different in the sense that I'm going to be looking at it, as you might imagine, from a different perspective, as an event that marks, in many, many ways, the end of the British Empire. As the longest reigning monarch in British history, Elizabeth had the time up there on the throne to preside over momentous closing chapters of that empire. I want to talk about that, partly because it's real history that we ought to think about. And like all history, it's right here with us right now. Not because of Britain, but because the empire role that Britain once played passed then to the United States, formerly part of that empire, and that the United States is now facing the decline.